Thanks, Tom. And as one of the 55 new members, thank you very much for admitting me into the organization. I'm very proud and honored to be a member of a prestigious organization like this. And I'm also very honored to have been affiliated with Mass General Hospital for 26 years. I started out really as a patient advocate because I was in charge of approximately 2,000 employees of a company and 4,000 of their family. And to the extent anyone got into serious trouble, my job was to get them over to Mass General and make sure they took great care of them. And so to have watched Mass General for 22 years do that, it's extraordinary what they did for so many people with so many difficult issues. And so I became a real believer in the hospital, and after I retired 5 years ago, I volunteered to help out their development office and do whatever they needed me to do at various functions and events. And I met Peter Slavin when he became president in the beginning of 2003, and I could say a lot about him, but to keep it brief, I'll just give you one statistic. When he became president in 2003, U.S. News and World had ranked Mass General as the number three hospital in the United States. Every year since 1990, they do an in-depth study where they actually do research on 5,000 hospitals and talk to 10,000 specialists to do their rankings of all the hospitals on 16 specialty care areas, from cancer to urology. And when Peter took over in 2003, Mass General was ranked number three. Under his leadership, they've moved up to number two, and then this past year they were ranked number one in the United States. So he is the general of the general, and there are 24,000 employees there. And following his leadership, they've done some extraordinary things. And also it's very important that he come to Naples, because outside of Boston, the number one city in the United States as far as having patients at Mass General is Naples, Florida. So without further ado, let me introduce Dr. Peter Slavin.
Oh, thank you. Paul, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you to the Forum Club for this invitation. I want to thank Paul and his wife, Kathy, for their involvement in leadership at Mass General, and the same for Tom and Robin Wheeler, who've been great friends of the hospital over the years. And I had a chance to meet a number of other very satisfied patients and supporters of the hospital who are here. So thank you all for your involvement. Nobody told me when I was giving this talk that I was going to have to follow five incredibly articulate and talented students, but I just and I want to congratulate the Forum Club for inviting young people like this to your club. I'm sure that the purpose of this invitation was to try to inspire these students to reach even higher, but I think, at least for me, I think they were even greater source of inspiration for me than this club is for them. So thanks again to the students, and please help me give them another round of applause. I'm certainly very honored and humbled to be asked to speak to you today. I had a chance to look through your website and see some of the people who have preceded me, including members of Congress, Supreme Court justices, the directors of the CIA, as well as the KGB. one of my heroes, who unfortunately just passed away recently, General Norman Schwarzkopf. And I wish I'd been here when you had Jesse Ventura address this this club. That must have been quite interesting. I also see you've had folks from other prestigious academic medical centers around the country, including Johns Hopkins and Mayo, and it was nice to have a chance to sit at lunch today with Alan Weiss, the head of Naples Community Hospital, and we're all very grateful to him for the great job that he and his staff do providing health care in this region. So today I wanted to share with you what, from my perspective, are some of the major challenges, in fact, four major challenges facing healthcare in the United States. And I think the timing for this discussion is very appropriate, because we are in the early stages of what I think will ultimately be a monumental transformation in the way that healthcare in this country is delivered, organized, and paid for. But before I get into that, those challenges in front of this esteemed audience, I can't help myself but doing a very brief advertorial about the institution that I hail from and have had the privilege of leading for the last 10 years. Mass General has been around now for 202 years. We were founded by the state of Massachusetts in 1811. We're the third oldest hospital in this country and the original and now the largest teaching hospital affiliated with Harvard Medical School. We were founded for two reasons. The more important of those two reasons was that back in 1811, medicine basically consisted of doctors visiting patients in their home. And in 1811, unfortunately, like is the case today, some people couldn't afford to pay the doctors, some people didn't have homes. And so this hospital was created by the state as a charitable undertaking to provide a place where poor people could receive care in a dignified fashion and where the doctors would volunteer their services to provide care to them. So that was the first reason why we were established. The second, which was also a very convenient one, is that Harvard Medical School had been founded more than 50 years prior to the opening of Mass General, and Mass General created a wonderful training site for Harvard Medical students, which continues through today. What we do on our campus between Beacon Hill and the west end of Boston is very similar to what we did in 1811 or in 1821 when our doors actually opened. We do four things simultaneously. We provide care to patients, we do biomedical research, we educate the next generation of healthcare professionals, and we also try to improve the health of the communities we serve. This past year, we admitted about 50,000 patients to the hospital, saw about 1.5 million outpatients, 90,000 of whom were seen in our emergency department, and we also did 40,000 surgical procedures and about 3,600 births. In addition to being a very busy clinical facility, we have the largest research program of any hospital in the United States, and it spans the gamut from very basic genetics research all the way to research on health policy and everything in between. We remain deeply committed to education, not only of physicians, but to nurses, other healthcare professionals. And at any given time, we have thousands of trainees, including hundreds of Harvard Medical students, spending time at MGH learning. We also remain very committed to community health and have very intense and close relationships with some local disadvantaged communities like Chelsea and Charlestown. But increasingly, our community health program is also focused on communities around the world. And we're very honored that in 2011, the Association of American Medical Colleges recognized our community health program as being the best of any teaching hospital or medical school in this country. As Paul said, we are the largest employer in the city of Boston with somewhere between 24 and 25,000 employees. And we were, again, humbled this past year to be ranked number one by U.S. News. Although when that happened, I said three things to our staff. One is that ranking hospitals is far from a perfect science, so we need to take those rankings with a grain of salt. Two, the last thing we would want to see is for us to become complacent as a result of this ranking. We always need to be focused first and foremost on getting even better. And then finally, we don't really view the competition that we face every day as being Johns Hopkins or the Mayo Clinic. Our competition is cancer, heart disease, mental illness, and the other diseases that affect our patients and their families so much. And that is what our staff gets up every morning to fight as hard as they possibly can. So that officially ends my MGH advertorial. I apologize for that brief commercial. And now I'd like to just move into the four issues that I wanted to cover today. And I thought, without any slides, that rather than dizzying you with a bunch of verbal statistics or policy positions, that maybe the best way to introduce each of those issues was to tell you a story. Because it is the stories in healthcare, stories about our patients, stories about our doctors and nurses, and stories about the interactions among them that really, I think, conveys how critically important healthcare is and how important the critical issues we're facing can be. So the first of those stories involves a patient of Mass General, and his name was Louis Toxin. Louis was a Jewish immigrant from Lithuania who settled about 10 miles north of Boston around 1910. And shortly after he arrived in the United States, he developed an infection in the bone in the front of his lower leg, something that what we now refer to as tibial osteomyelitis. And today that infection is a pretty trivial medical problem, but back in 1920 it was a very serious medical problem because there were no antibiotics available at that time to treat it. So he and his family did a little bit of research as to where the best treatment was, and they determined that the best treatment available to him was at Mass General Hospital. And for the next 10 years, he came every week by streetcar, accompanied by his young daughter, to receive dressings applied to his leg to keep that infection under control. And in fact, for 10 years, he was able to maintain his leg before he ultimately needed to go on to get an amputation. Why do I raise Lewis Toxin? I guess for two reasons. One, that daughter that accompanied him every week for 10 years was my grandmother. He was my great-grandfather, after whom I'm named. And I also mention it because he was he had made very little money being in the poultry business in the city of Malden, and all the care that Mass General provided to him was provided at no cost. It was provided for free. And I guess if you come to visit me in my office, you will see a picture of my great-grandfather on the wall. He serves as a great inspiration for me every day, and I think symbolizes for me, and I hope for others, the importance of being able to access health care in a timely and affordable way in order to have the best outcomes possible. And that's the first issue that I wanted to mention, namely the issue of health care access, because that is a huge issue for many people in this country, millions of people. There are currently 50 million uninsured individuals in the United States. I'm very proud to come from the state of Massachusetts, which decided to tackle that issue head on about 5 years ago. We in Massachusetts had about 8% of our residents uninsured, and thanks to a bill that made it through our legislature and signed into law by our governor, Governor Romney at the time, that rate of uninsured is down to 2%. And the program that made that possible was a complicated mix of an individual mandate, an employer mandate, and premium subsidies for low-income individuals. But it has worked, from my perspective, extraordinarily well. If you look at what's happened to the uninsured, for people who are uninsured, they live with double jeopardy. On the one hand, they live in fear of getting sick and incurring health care bills that they can't afford, and so they defer needed health care services. And what's very heartening to me is that if you look at the outcomes of care for people who were previously uninsured, there's increasing evidence that they are better in Massachusetts. They are not only realizing a financial benefit from this program, but a health care benefit as well. And that is why I was very pleased that on March 23, 2010, President Obama signed into law the Affordable Care Act, which now will cover 32 million of the 50 million Americans who don't have health insurance. That bill is based largely on the Massachusetts plan, and as I said, in Massachusetts at least, it is working extremely well. We are already as a society realizing some of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. There are no longer any annual or lifetime limits on insurance policies. And also young people under the age of 26 are now eligible to be on their family plan, including my 25-year-old son. Many of the benefits are still to come in the future, and it is going to be a complicated undertaking to implement it in all 50 states, but I personally am very pleased that we are, as a country, are tackling this issue that affected my great-grandfather and is affecting so many millions of Americans today. Second story I wanted to tell you about was another patient of the MGH, and her name is Arlene. And back in 2006, she was 92 years old and enrolled in a program that we established at that time called the Mass General Care Management Program. That program was developed in collaboration with the federal government, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and was a program, an experiment, to try to figure out if we could focus a lot of attention on our 2,500 sickest and most costly Medicare-covered patients at Mass General Hospital and see if we could make their care better and less costly at the same time. Arlene at that time was 92 years old. She had diabetes, coronary artery disease, spinal stenosis, and was hard of hearing and poor vision. And complicating her medical situation is that she lived with her adult son, who was developmentally delayed, and he was her primary caregiver, and she was his primary caregiver. She loved her son deeply and was determined to be with him and care for him as long as possible, but with her own declining health, she wanted to be sure he would have the support and care that when she was no longer there. When she first enrolled in this program, a nurse was assigned to her. Her name was Melissa, a care manager in this program, and she became very involved with Arlene and her son. And And Melissa quickly recognized that in order for her to be maximally effective, that she would need to develop the trust of this family. At first, Arlene had no interest in using any of Melissa's services, but over time, their relationship blossomed. And in the year prior to enrolling in the program, Arlene had been a patient in our emergency room and in our hospital 7 different times, and this was because she often skipped medical appointments because of transportation problems or because she simply didn't want to leave her son alone. And Melissa and other members of her care team, her social worker, her community resource specialist, worked with her and helped with things like medication management, wheelchair transportation, and short-term rehab care. And over the next several years, all those services resulted in her in never being in our emergency room and never being admitted to the hospital. Unfortunately, her declining health resulted in her ultimately needing to be institutionalized, and her son also moved to an assisted living facility. But I mention this story not only to show that medical problems and social problems can intersect very carefully, but very critically, but just to say that it is, from our vantage point, possible through programs like this, by better coordinating care, to make care better and more affordable at the same time. This program, if you look at its impact on the 2,500 patients that it covered, saved about 12% of the costs associated with the care of those individuals. The program cost about 5%, so the net savings were 7%. And another way to think about it for the business people in this room, for every dollar we spent in the program, we saved Medicare $2.65. And the reason I raise this story is because I think that one of the biggest threats to the health of the public of this country is the rising cost of health care itself. It is putting enormous pressure on our government's budget, on businesses' budget, on individual budgets. Healthcare simply cannot continue to grow at 2% faster than the rest of the economy forevermore. We need to figure out ways to make care better and more affordable. And we've certainly learned that providing care management to people who are very sick, and by care management I mean taking care of them not only when they're in the hospital or standing in front of their doctor, but caring for them through programs like this all the time, can clearly make their care better and more efficient as well. And there are dozens of other things that have been shown to do similar things, things like trying to do a better job using radiology services more judiciously or using generic medications whenever possible. There are lots of ways to improve care and make it more efficient, and I think the faster that we implement them as a healthcare system, the more likely it is that we're going to be able to simply trim the fat and not have to cut into the muscle of our healthcare system when the economic pressures grow even further. I think another thing that contributes to rising healthcare costs is the way that healthcare is paid for in this country, the fee-for-service system, and we are migrating dramatically away from it in Massachusetts and at Mass General and in the healthcare system that we created at Partners Healthcare. We are now a pioneer ACO so that all of our Medicare patients are paid for through a global payment, not a fee-for-service system, and we've also converted our 3 major contracts to global payments as well. Again, I think the rising costs of healthcare in this country do create a very serious public health threat. I think they jeopardize a lot of other things as well. And I just want to quote briefly from Bill Gates, who in February of last year wrote, "How many teachers are you willing to fire in order to have 78-year-olds have a procedure which will be invented 5 years from now that adds 4 months to their life? That sounds terrible, but infinitely choosing those things will shift you away from education for the young and towards infinite invention of such medical procedures." I certainly hope as a society that we can continue to afford things that add 4 months to people's lives regardless of how old they are, but we need to do a much better job getting the fat out of the healthcare system, and that's an area that we are trying to play a leadership role in pursuing. The third story I wanted to share with you is about a young woman named Jen Searle. And at an early age, Jen developed an unusual disease called Alport syndrome, which over time damages the blood vessels in the kidneys. And at age 13, her Alport disease had progressed to the fact that she was already on hemodialysis and she underwent a kidney transplant from her father. In order to prevent her immune system from rejecting her kidney, her father's kidney, she had to take these very powerful but effective immunosuppressant medications. In fact, she was on 20 pills a day to prevent rejection. And these drugs have very serious side effects. And in her case, the biggest side effect was that they were causing these very painful warts to grow on her feet, making it almost impossible for her to walk. When her doctors tried to adjust the medicines downward in order to better control that side effect, her body began rejecting her father's kidney. In 2002, when she was in her 20s and had spent half of her year fighting failing kidneys, she heard about an experimental tolerance procedure going on at Mass General that might free her from having to take any drugs for immunosuppression in the future. And indeed, she underwent a procedure at the hospital called mixed chimerism, a procedure in which the recipient's immune system is infused with cells from the donor to trick her immune system into thinking that her new kidney is actually her own. And in fact, Jen, for 2 weeks, needed to be on immunosuppression after this procedure, but then that was gradually tapered off. And now, 10 years later, she's on no immunosuppression at all, and she is running marathons and is also now a very happy MGH employee as well. And so the reason I raise Jen's story is because biomedical research is incredibly important in this country and in this world. Jen's story was made possible by a very talented physician and his working very closely with people in our laboratories to make tolerance for transplant therapy possible. But there are many other miracles going on in cancer therapy, heart disease, et cetera. As Louis Pasteur said, take interest in laboratories, demand that they be multiplied, that they be adorned. These are the temples of the future, temples of well-being and happiness. This is that there it is that humanity grows greater, stronger, and better. And the reason I raise biomedical research is, number one, we have a big commitment to it at Mass General, but two, biomedical research in this country is under severe threat. And the threat is that the single biggest funder of biomedical research in this country is the National Institutes of Health, a federal agency that spends about $30 billion a year supporting biomedical research. If sequestration indeed happens in 2 months, the budget of that agency will be cut by 9%, and research around this country will be devastated, and I suspect young people, like some of the ones we heard about, who might be interested in pursuing research careers, will be so discouraged by the funding prospects that they may choose to do other things. The NIH budget is not only important because of the hope that it gives so many people through the research that it supports, but also because of the economic benefits that it provides. We are the world leader in biomedical research in this country, and as I learned in an economics course I took as an undergraduate, one of the best ways to stimulate long-term economic growth is to invest in research and development. And there's great evidence that the research that the NIH has funded over the years has in turn led to great economic prosperity in this country through the pharmaceutical and biotech and device industry that it has helped foster. So cutting the NIH budget at this moment in time seems like a great tragedy for two reasons. One is it will slow our progress against things like heart disease, cancer, mental illness, and other terrible problems. But also, I think it in the long term will compromise our economic growth and our ability to dig out of our federal deficit through growth. In some ways, it reminds me of a decision that a pilot might make, the pilot of an airplane losing altitude, thinking about what to do in order to maintain altitude. And I think cutting the NIH budget would be the equivalent of that pilot deciding to jettison one of his or her engines at that moment in time. That wouldn't be a very smart thing to do. And so I hope that our policy leaders in Washington are sensible in whatever decisions are made in the coming months about the NIH budget. And then the final story I wanted to share with you is not one of about one of our patients, but about one of our physicians. And her name is Kate Treadway. And Kate is an extraordinary primary care physician and also one of the best teachers we have as well. In fact, Kate is the person at Harvard Medical School who teaches all the second-year students in their first clinical course. And I want to share with you part of the lesson that she taught, and this is a story that she told to her students and one that she published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2005. And I quote, "When I was a third-year medical student doing my pediatric rotation, I was walking down the hospital corridor with my intern one night, making rounds on the recent admissions. The intern stopped at the door of a patient who I knew was not somebody that we were responsible for. The intern told me, I need to see this patient and her family. I know them because she has been here several times this past year. When we walked into the room, I saw a 7-year-old girl lying on a bed. She was breathing the loud liquid breaths I would come to know as the death rattle. Her skin was brilliant yellow, her abdomen massively swollen from the tumor that was killing her. She had no hair and her limbs were stick thin. With her were her parents and both sets of grandparents, and we walked in, her mother stood up. My intern walked over to her and put his arms around her, and they stood silently holding each other. After a few minutes, the mother stepped back and looked at her daughter, at the unbearable scene before her, and said, "You know, I never thought I would want her to die, but I do want her to die." Somehow, when they said there was nothing more they could do, I pictured her in a field of flowers, and she'd just be gone. I never thought it would be like this. My intern taught me a profoundly important lesson that night. Many doctors would have walked right by that door because everything had been done. The diagnosis had been made, the correct treatment had been given, the complications appropriately treated, and now the girl was dying and there was nothing more to do. But what my intern taught me that night was that there was one more thing to do, to go into that room and offer whatever comfort his care and concern could bring, to bear witness to the pain of that family. In the end, it was important as anything else that had been done for that child. In the long years ahead, if you ask the mother what she remembered of that time, I suspect that one memory would be of my intern holding her. The lesson he taught me that night was that in the practice of medicine, the person you are is as important as what you know. So I raise Kate's story to exemplify or underscore an incredibly important aspect of medicine that has been there since the very beginning, and that is the compassion that I think people receiving healthcare so desperately are seeking for, and that the best healthcare providers love to provide. And so no matter what changes happen in our healthcare system in the coming years, as we redesign care, we clearly need to adopt to our patients' needs and make sure that their medical, emotional, social, spiritual needs are cared for, supported, and tended to. This is certainly the healthcare system that I would like to see be maintained and unfold. It's certainly the kind of care that my great-grandfather received about 100 years, and the kind that I have really appreciate when it is bestowed upon myself or members of my family. I'm sure it's the kind of healthcare that all of you want as well. So as we work hard to improve access to healthcare, to better controlling its costs, to fostering innovation in care, we first and foremost need to remember to protect and nurture the sacred relationships between patients and their caregivers that can make healthcare so special to deliver and so wonderful to receive. Compassion, trust, open communication, and positive patient-caregiver relationships must be the platform upon which our healthcare system is built. Basic humanity must be our guidepost as we enter into an era of national healthcare reform. So again, I want to thank you for the privilege of speaking with you today, and I very much look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Peter, there are a lot of cards, so I've tried to group some of them.
Okay.
The first one is, outside of getting rid of Obamacare, how can we increase the number of doctors?
Well, I don't agree with the premise of that question. I hope Obamacare is given a chance to do all the good things I think it has the potential to doing. In terms of increasing the number of doctors, applications to medical schools have never been higher in this country. The quality of people that are applying to medical schools has never been better. Medical school slots have actually been expanding in this country by about 15% over the last 10 years. Unfortunately, the number of slots, residency slots in teaching hospitals has not been increased by the federal government, so that would be a nice thing to see happen. We are, given the aging of the population, likely to see shortage of physicians in various specialties, and I hope, we'll need to keep a close eye on that. I know some people use that the shortage of physicians as an excuse for why we should kill Obamacare. I just don't think, if I was one of the 50 million Americans without health insurance, I'd much rather have health insurance and have a hard time accessing a doctor than no health insurance at all, so I don't buy that excuse.
These two are related. How important is hospice to the healthcare system, and should hospice care at home be expanded to reduce hospital care?
Hospice is extremely important, and if you looked at our Medicare demonstration project, that Medicare care management program that I described, every measure of utilization, with the exception of one, went down. Hospital stays went down 20%, doctor's visits went down 20%, emergency room visits went down 20%, hospice care actually went up. And actually, our patients live longer than the control group. So it wasn't that hospice care increased because patients were dying sooner. They were dying at a later stage. But it is definitely a very humane and less expensive way for patients to die than in an intensive care unit or a hospital bed.
It is estimated that 80% of global pain medication is administered in the United States. What can be done to reduce this disproportionate usage and change over doctors giving out prescriptions?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I'm not sure I understand that.
It is estimated that 80% of global pain medication is administered in the United States.
I see. There may be a lot of pain in this country. I'm not sure. We use much more in the way of healthcare technology than any other country in the world. Cardiac surgery, angioplasty, so it doesn't surprise me that our use of pain meds is also higher. And that's, if you look at why healthcare in the United States is about 50% more expensive than any other country in the world, the biggest answer is that, you know, we use a lot more technology and a lot more expensive things than in other countries. Whether that care associated with that is always better is uncertain.
Okay. This is a question from a student. How are educational opportunities different at your hospital than any other hospital?
There are lots of great places to train in this country. I was fortunate to do my training at Mass General. I'm obviously biased toward the place. I think at most teaching hospitals, they're not sure what their top priority is, whether it's clinical care, research. At some hospitals, research is definitely the top priority, and in some of those, clinical care is viewed as a necessary evil in order to be able to do research. At Mass General, there's no doubt, I think, in anyone's mind that although we have the largest research program in the country, clinical care is the most important thing that we do, and everybody recognizes that. And so if you want to train in an environment where that's really the heart of the heart of the matter, then welcome to Mass General.
Okay. This will definitely be your favorite question.
Okay.
I would like to make a donation. To what address do I send the check?
Does everybody have their pen out ready to write it down? No, we're very fortunate. We, as Paul knows, started a capital campaign a few years ago. We hit our goal just a few weeks ago, a year ahead of schedule. We've raised over $1.5 billion, and we're going to continue the campaign through its original schedule through the end of this calendar year. But we'd be welcome, I'd be happy to accept any donations, and I'd be happy to give you that address offline. It's available on our website.
These two are related. One of the greatest drawbacks of the healthcare of our healthcare costs are diseases of affluence and lifestyle, such as obesity, diabetes, etc. What is Mass General doing to address these concerns? And the second question is Mass General working on a cure for diabetes?
The answer to both is yes. As far as what we're doing, we are in our community health programs. One of the most important things that we're focusing on with communities of Revere and Chelsea is how do we stem the tide of childhood obesity, which is such a huge problem. And it's not only a medical problem, it's a social problem. If you look in those communities, accessing healthy foods, finding places to exercise is a real problem. So we're parts of coalitions in those communities trying to attract people who sell fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods to sell them in those communities. We're trying to work with them to develop bicycle trails, parks where kids can exercise. We're working with the school systems to try to increase the amount of exercise that kids are exposed to during the course of their schools. It is unfortunate that one of the first things that gets cut as schools face tight budgets is recreation and exercise, when some people think that should be the first part of the curriculum, not the last. And on the research side, there are many of our investigators in different specialties, endocrinology, genetics, and others, who are trying to tackle diabetes tackle the problem of obesity from a number of different vantage points.
Please comment on MGH's programs of DNA and stem cell.
Yeah, we have a very robust DNA or genetics program. Probably the place where it is having the biggest impact is in our cancer center. If you're a patient in our cancer center, and have a new diagnosis of cancer, your tumor will be genotyped so that we can understand what mutations are behind it and whether there are any drugs available on the market that might target those mutations. So genetics is having a revolutionary impact on the care of cancer patients at MGH today. This kind of approach is being rolled out slowly in other parts of the country. I was just over in China. It's not being used at all in that country at all, but it is having a remarkable impact on our patients. As far as stem cell research goes, we are part of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. We have at Mass General the largest part of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute there at the hospital. I think originally when stem cell research got off the ground, people thought it was going to lead to us coming up with stem cells that could repair organs, and that there is still some hope that that will happen, but it has given us enormous insights into various diseases and resulted in new medical therapies for diseases that otherwise wouldn't have been possible. So it's an area of great excitement in research, and we're very bullish about it.
Another question from a student. In your opinion, will the Affordable Care Act affect the price of medical care in the future?
I guess I'd say two things. If you look at the Massachusetts experiment, the rate of rise in healthcare costs in Massachusetts since our health reform bill was passed has been slower than the rest of the country. Nationwide healthcare has been going up over the last 5 years about 5.5%, in Massachusetts at about 4.5%. And secondly, the Affordable Care Act has in it more provisions than our health reform bill did to try to control healthcare costs, particularly when it comes to Medicare. I mentioned this our demonstration project at the hospital that played out over the last 6 years. Well, the Affordable Care Act provides the federal government, when it comes to the Medicare program, to sponsor many more experiments like that around the country to figure out how care can be made better and more affordable simultaneously, and when it finds them, then implement those policies through the Medicare program without having to get permission from the Congress. So I think the Affordable Care Act has various provisions in it that give me hope that care may become less affordable. And if you look at the rate of rise of healthcare costs in this country in the last few years, the increases have been the smallest in recent memory. That's probably largely due to the economy. Healthcare expenses do tend to track economic growth, but I do think there are lots of changes going on within the healthcare system that might have some more lasting impact.
How can 30 million new patients be cared for without an increase in the number of doctors?
Some of them are getting care today, but they're getting care in emergency rooms. They're getting care much later in their course of breast cancer or high blood pressure. So they are getting some care, but there's no doubt that we're going to need more physicians, particularly more primary care physicians, to be able to provide care to 30 million additional Americans. And so the workforce will have to catch up with the demand. But I don't see that as being a good excuse for stopping those 30 million Americans from getting health insurance.
Is the immune suppression drug you discussed in your talk available to all transplant patients now?
Innovation that I mentioned, tolerance, really doesn't involve any drugs at all. It involves somewhat of a bone marrow transplant at the same time that the solid organ is infused. It is still very much of a research protocol. We are doing cases at Mass General, so it is not widely available as of yet.
How much did MGH spend for the server farm to store all the human genome data?
I don't know.
You described a pending 9% cut to NIH as having extreme consequences. Isn't this an exaggeration?
Well, back in the 90s, the NIH budget was actually doubled, and since that time, the budget has been largely flat, and if you take into account the impact of inflation, the impact of the doubling has basically gone away. Right now, if you're an investigator and apply to the NIH for funding, unless your grant in some of the institutes is at the sixth percentile, namely it's been viewed as better than 94 of 100 of 100 grants, it's only if you're in the top 6% that you're going to get funded. 94% of grants get rejected, and that's before this 9% cut occurs. So back 10 years ago, the success rate for grants was more in the 20 to 30% range, which is still pretty competitive, at 6% or lower, I think it's becoming extreme, and there are going to be a lot of people who are currently very actively involved in research who lose their funding and will need to do something else. And what I worry most about is that some young people, seeing this daunting challenge, will decide to do something else. So I don't think it's extreme at all.
I would say at least 10 cards, Peter, are on this subject having to do with costs. So I'll just read one of them. How can the current pay-for-services model be sustainable? Don't we need a new incentive model?
We do need a new incentive model, and that's why we are trying to migrate away from the fee-for-service model. Fee-for-service medicine rewards doctors and hospitals for providing more services rather than less services, and we for probably about a third of our patients are being paid for under what's called the global payment system, where we get a fixed amount for caring for an individual over the course of the year, regardless of what services they need. And at the end of the year, if we come in below that global budget, we share with the insurer some of the savings, and if we exceed the budget, we actually have to write a check to the insurer for part of the overage. So that obviously dramatically changes the incentives and gives us the incentive to invest in the kind of program that I described Arlene benefited from. We have an incentive to keep people out of the hospital, an incentive to keep them well at home, and we are making a huge investment as we go from now being at risk for 2,500 patients under that experiment. We're now, across our healthcare system, at risk for 500,000 patients, and so we are investing dramatically in the type in more Melissas to help manage folks at home.
Do you see rationing? Do you foresee rationing in the next decade? And if so, how would that affect people in this room?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I desperately hope we can avoid. And we just need doctors, hospitals, providers across this country trying to innovate as rapidly as they can to make care better and more affordable. Because I guess I hold out hope that if we do that, we'll be able to trim the fat out of the healthcare system and be able to spare the muscle. If we don't do that, and if the pressures through the federal budget and through other means really constrain healthcare growth when we don't really know how to deliver it well and in a less costly fashion, I'm afraid that we're going to have to cut into the muscle. And whether that involves rationing or other approaches, I don't know. But I hope it'll be a sad day if we are forced to do that.
How much of medical delivery inefficiency is caused by lawyers?
I don't want to offend our student who was thinking about a legal career. But clearly there are some costs that are currently baked into our healthcare system related to defensive medicine. I don't know how much those costs are, maybe a couple of percentage points, maybe more. I don't think that they are driving healthcare costs up. I don't think that factor is increasing in terms of its importance. But I think if we could come up with a better a malpractice system, maybe a no-fault system like exists for cars, that maybe we could trim some of that expense.
And the last one, have you lost employers due to increases in the cost of insurance plans, and have benefits covered been reduced to increase the number of covered individuals?
What's encouraging to me in Massachusetts is that with the passage of mass health reform, the percentage of businesses providing health insurance to their employees has actually gone up, not gone down. Businesses have not wiped their hands clean of health insurance, have not simply agreed to pay this employer mandate, which is much less costly than the cost of insurance. So that gives me some hope. Clearly, a lot of businesses are increasing co-pays, increasing deductibles, and shifting more of the costs of the care to their employees. We're certainly seeing that in Massachusetts for sure. Thank you.
Peter, thank you. Peter, thank you. Thank you for being in Naples. Thank you for your presentation. And a couple of mementos for your trip down here.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate your help on everything.
They want you to share those with you.
I will. Thank you.